Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower. Now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with our second part in the series we've been doing about the Black Death, which is another name for the big outbreak at the beginning of the second plague pandemic. There have been three major pandemics in world history of plague caused by the bacterium Yersinia pestis. The second one of them is this big one in the late Middle Ages that began in the middle of the 14th century and then had these recurrent waves that went on for hundreds of years after that. And so in the last episode, we talked about, we talked about scientific questions about what the causative agent of the plague was, how it spread, and some of the outstanding questions about that. There's still a lot, actually, that is surprisingly unknown about how exactly these plague pandemics worked, or certainly the older ones before the one in the 19th and 20th century.
Yeah. So in this episode, we're going to look more at the contemporary response to the Black Death, the 14th century response to the Black Death. Well, what we know about the views on disease and illness at the time, and to what extent those were useful or useless against this onslaught of plague.
Now, Rob, I know one of the main reasons that you got interested in doing a series of episodes on the plague was that you were interested in religious responses to the plague. Mm-hmm. Like, what were the religions in the affected communities saying about the plague? And so that's what we've been looking into for this episode, and we'll probably end up doing another one after this. And this has been a really interesting subject, not only because it is inherently interesting, but actually the historiography of the subject is interesting. Like, there's been interesting recent scholarship on the historical analysis of the different religious responses to the Black Plague and how those analyses have worked and to what extent they're accurate. So, full disclosure, I think when we do start talking about comparative religious responses to the Black Plague, this is something that I think is probably still a matter of debate. This is also, like we were talking about in the last episode, not something that's just a settled set of facts that are a matter of the history books.
Right. And then also when we get into stuff like this, a lot of times there are some broad theories about how, okay, if you didn't have the Black Death, you wouldn't have had this, or because of the Black Death, this and this occurred. And some of these are very compelling cases, but we also have to remind ourselves that, like, you know, this is a complex game of trying to figure out how history comes together and, you know, what causes what. So, you know, butterfly wings are flapping all over the place. So, you know, we have to remind ourselves that nothing is 100% certain, but some of these arguments are rather interesting. Well, let's go ahead and start here in the world of Christian Europe at the time. And I thought we might begin by just looking at the broader view of illness and also ultimately the divine. Basically, how did people at this time in this region view the cause of disease? What did they think about disease? Where did they think it came from? And how did they think you should attempt to treat it? And so I thought we might run through some of the key ideas here. And some of these we've discussed on the show before, sometimes at length. So for starters, there was the idea of the four humors. And this was rooted in the work of Hippocrates, that an imbalance of the four humors of blood, phlegm, black bile, and yellow bile could result in disease. And this idea had been built on by Galen and others. So it basically said, you know, to treat illness, one would need to rebalance the humors. And there were various ways of doing this, but we know now that this was not correct.
And this is, in fact, one of the main lines of thinking leading to a major treatment of the Middle Ages and beyond, which is the treatment of bloodletting, or actually not just bloodletting, various purging procedures that would try to purge people of excess fluids within the body when it was thought that their humors were out of balance. So if you had too much blood in the body, and maybe that's leading to I don't recall exactly, maybe a fever or something like that. I could have that wrong. What they thought led to what, but you could alleviate that by punching a hole in the body and allowing excess blood to run out.
Right. Now, next, there was the idea that illness spread via bad air, and this was miasma theory, which we've definitely discussed on the show before. This also had been advanced by Hippocrates. So again, an idea rooted in classical thought and some of the, you know, what were considered the best ideas concerning the natural world of the time. So as we've discussed on the show before, the notion of bad and foul air being the thing that allows disease to travel and infect, that would mean, therefore, the removal of bad air or the positioning of yourself further from bad air would be a way to prevent or combat illness. Now, interestingly enough, this approach can work accidentally in some cases, but again, this one too is not correct.
Yeah, so we've actually done at least one whole episode on miasma theory before, maybe multiple episodes. So if you go into the back catalog, you can probably find that somewhere. But yeah, miasma theory is very interesting, especially because its mechanisms are not always easy to nail down. But yeah, it's generally the idea that there's something in the air, often a foul smelling air or some kind of bad air or bad vapor that could have a number of proximate causes of its own. It may be air that is caused by a conjunction of the planets or something, or it might be released from deep in the earth during an earthquake, and all of these things might ultimately be something you could trace back to a supernatural cause, as many people in Christian Europe would. They would say, you know, well, here are the proximate causes. It's bad air that was, say, released by the planets or released by an earthquake, but ultimately it's God. It's God is punishing us, and we'll come back to the theological interpretations in a moment. I was reading a work by a historian named Michael W. Doles, who lived 1942 to 1989, who was a historian of medicine and a historian of the Middle East. He published a book called The Black Death in the Middle East in 1977. I think it was actually his doctoral dissertation. But he's a widely cited scholar on this subject and also I want to come back either in this episode or in the next episode with more recent scholarship that has offered some critiques of Doles's generalizations about religious responses to the plague. So this, it's not just like what he says goes for all time. But in an essay I was reading called The Comparative Communal Responses to the Black Death in Muslim and Christian Societies, published in the 70s, he's writing, before he gets into the religious responses, he's writing about the dominant mechanistic theories of plague transmission within both Christian and Muslim societies. And he writes that both of these societies tended to have this same dominant mechanical theory of the spread of plague. So both of them were largely working from miasma theory, like you're talking about, the idea that plague is caused by bad air. And this is because communities of both religions were largely drawing on the same medical traditions, like you mentioned, Hippocrates, the elaboration on Hippocrates by Galen, but then also Ibn Sina, or also known as Avicenna. And as a result of the belief in miasma theory, a common preventative to infection under this theory is what might be called changing the air. And so this could have interpretations that would actually be useful, even though the theory is wrong, and could have interpretations that would be completely useless. So it might mean, say, getting out of the area where the bad air is. You know, you're changing the air by changing your location. So if everybody around you is getting infected, that probably means there's some bad air around and you need to get away from it so you could flee. But then also it could mean something like sweetening the air. This was a common practice of infusing the air you breathe with pleasant scents like herbs or flowers or fresh fruits. And so when you see those plague doctor masks, like we talked about in the previous episode, that might have a beak or some kind of protuberance coming from where the mouth and the nose would be, that presumably the person wearing the mask is breathing through. Not having a germ theory of disease, they were not thinking about trying to filter out droplets bearing viral particles. Instead, they were thinking about filtering the air coming into your mouth and nose with sweet smells. So those protuberances in the mask would often be stuffed with herbs or something like that.
Right. And then I think at least in some cases, the idea too was that there was still an opening right next to either nostril. So
yeah,
so that there were a number of problems with that design, which, again, to be clear, was not would not have been in use during this time period. It would have come centuries later. And there's still some dispute as to how widespread they actually were.
But despite the fact that they come later and they might not have been as widespread as you might get an impression, they still do reflect the dominant thinking about the mechanistic causes of disease transmission at the time.
And it's understandable because you basically have a learned system here that matches up closely with some of our natural responses to, say, revolting or alarming smells, you mm-hmm. know, like basically aligns up with some of our body's natural defenses against potentially poisonous or infectious agents.
Right. I mean, so we have natural disgust reactions that are almost certainly evolved to protect us from infectious disease. Like, why is it that we tend to find the body fluids of other people and animals revolting and like we want to get away from them? It's probably because that is an evolved response. An animal that happens to be disgusted by body fluids and stays away from them is less likely to contract an infectious disease. Mm-hmm. So that's also an area in which, even though the person who has this disgust reaction might not understand the mechanism, it's that, oh, tiny organisms might get into my body and then start colonizing and infecting me. The intuition provided by the disgust reaction is itself protective, even though you wouldn't understand the reason why. But anyway, coming back to the other half of it, so another way of changing the air is to change your location, right? So if you get away from where you perceive there to be a cloud of miasma, you might also be getting yourself away from real vectors of disease, which could be a number of things. I mean, we talked about different theories of this in the last episode, but you could be getting yourself away from host populations of infected animals like commensal rodents, which are carrying fleas, which would deliver the infectious bite, or away from infected people, who could possibly be spreading the disease directly, either through droplets that they're coughing out, leaving the nose and mouth if they have pneumonic plague, an infection of the lungs, or getting away from infected people who are transmitting plague to other people through their human ectoparasites, which is a finding of a recent study we talked about. I think it was from 2018 or so. That said, for a number of plague outbreaks, it looks like the best explanatory model for how the plague spreads is if it's being spread person to person through things like human lice and human fleas.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, getting away from where plague is an effective method of protecting yourself, no matter which of these vectors is the dominant one.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On-demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Now, from this point, we get into some of the more supernatural causes, and we can certainly lump these all together and just say, all right, supernatural causes of the disease, of the plague, or we can divide them up into a few different categories. On one hand, I think we can easily state that the supernatural is never the cause of an illness, and therefore, by and large, supernatural solutions are not going to work. Roughly speaking, I think we can look at three different categories and we can discuss them from there. So first of all, there's the supernatural individual level. So disease is a result of sin, like individual sin, a punishment for sin, or a test administrated by supernatural forces. Generally, we're talking about God or an agent of God. Medieval thinking tended to limit the extent to which demons could actually mess with flesh. This is something that was discussed in the works of Aristotle, and Thomas Aquinas had laid in on this. So there were certain limits, like the idea that the devil could not turn you into an animal, because that would be in defiance of natural law. But other things were permitted. So you can kind of it gets into kind of a messy theological area. But for the most part, when people were looking for a cause of the plague, they were not looking to hell, they were looking to heaven.
Yeah, from everything I've been reading, this was especially the overwhelming supernatural explanation used throughout Christian Europe at the time, was that that disease, especially plague, is in some way a punishment for sin, and often an individual punishment for sin. And of course, this could give rise to all kinds of theodicy-type questions, right? Mm-hmm. Where theodicy, of course, being the subject of believers trying to justify the ways of God to man, this could give rise to questions like, well, why would innocent children catch this disease? You know, they're too young to be culpable for sin in the same way adults are, and this was addressed in numerous ways. Some people might say, well, it's actually their parents are being punished for their sin, or and they're saying that the children will get to go to heaven, their parents are being punished, or it might be said that the children have disobeyed the commandments to honor thy father and mother, so they're, you know, by being disobedient to their parents, they are actually being punished. But yeah, supernatural punishment seems to have been an overwhelmingly common interpretation, especially within Christian Europe.
I do want to add a caveat, though, about like the limited powers of demonic forces, is that you're going to also encounter exceptions to that rule, certainly when you're dealing with individual surviving folkloric and mythological ideas. But this is just sort of by and large, like how the learned members of society would have interpreted the problem. Now, an extension of the supernatural individual category is the supernatural group category, which we're already discussing a little bit here. This is the same as previously explained, but roughly applied to an entire city, an entire people or culture, and generally limited to, you know, the judgment of divine forces again. So there's something is wrong in our culture or in our church or in our kingdom or in our world entirely. We've fallen astray, and therefore the Almighty is punishing us. And then another category, and this kind of gets down to a lot of the, like I say, the sort of ground level folkloric ideas, the idea that witchcraft and magic were involved. This is something encountered in cultures around the world generally, the idea that disease may be caused by others practicing magic against you. Mm-hmm. This generates ideas concerning witches and sorcerers, but also leads to all manner of othering and persecution in response to illness. Something bad is happening to us. Illness is here. Someone is responsible, and we have to do something about it.
Yeah, and as you allude to, and as anyone might guess, this particular interpretation can have really disastrous consequences.
Yeah. So again, none of these understandings of disease are actually valid, and none of them are really going to work. Certainly, some of them may seem to work, and they may seem to work in certain cases with other illnesses, but then here comes the Black Death with just staggering mortality rates. We got into this a bit in the last episode, but the numbers are going to vary, but I've seen like a rough 30 to 75% mortality rate for plague. I've seen bubonic with an 80% mortality rate during this time, and I've seen the other varieties of plague with, you know, upwards of 90 to 100% of mortality. So it's, staggering numbers to consider.
Yeah, with pneumonic or septicemic plagues, the other two versions, and again, they're all caused by the same bacterium. It's all mm-hmm. Yersinia pestis. It's just about how the body gets infected. So pneumonic is infection of the lung tissue. Like if either bubonic plague progresses to a lung infection, or if you inhale the bacterium directly and it gives you a primary lung infection, that's pneumonic plague. Septicemic plague is infection of the bloodstream with the Yersinia pestis. And either way, these are just absolutely devastating. Like without very quick antibiotic treatments, and I do think it's important to stress that even in the modern world, with these versions of plague, you've got to catch it early with the antibiotics to be effective. because these forms of the disease can progress shockingly rapidly. There are stories from the Middle Ages of people going to bed seemingly okay and then just being dead by the next morning. It's a shockingly rapid progression. And the mortality rates without early antibiotic intervention are somewhere near 100%.
Now, some of the prevention and treatment practices of the day were certainly in line with the four humors and the miasma theory. On the later front, one of the most consequential views was that, again, one could just simply move from an area with bad air to one with better air. But all of this was more prevalent in the early days of the Black Death. As it progressed, you saw more of a turning to potential religious cures and religious treatments, religious responses to the plague.
Yeah, because if you are following this view in Christian, that's very common in Christian Europe, that the plague is being caused by sin and it is a punishment for sin, then you would think that the primary way of alleviating it would be doing something about the underlying cause, doing something about the state of sin that you're in and trying to fix that in order to get God to relent with the disaster.
Yeah. And so like the most obvious treatment here is, okay, if God has allowed this to happen or caused this to happen, I need to get on the phone with God. And I do have a way, I have a direct line. I can pray. We can all pray. Mm-hmm. And so that was one method, turn to prayer, prayer to God, and various other religious approaches come into play too here, the use of amulets and charms as a means of aiding prayer or as a means of protecting against plague, even as the idea that some form of contagion was taking place, like the idea that it was it became apparent that something was happening. It was somehow spreading from person to person. Even if you got into this view, there was still the idea, well, an amulet can stand between me and that. It can be the thing that protects me. And when this didn't appear to work, we can certainly understand why more extreme methods were then explored. Like if prayer doesn't work and amulets are not working, then maybe I'm not trying hard enough, and therefore God is still not removing this plague from my shoulders.
And here you get into some of the most interesting theological reasoning that that appeared in Christian Europe in response to the plague, which is picking up on pre-existing ideas about the powers of the mortification of the flesh.
Yes. The various flagellant groups, for example. You've probably seen art and you've seen paintings depicting these individuals before, often people in white clothing, making like minor parades through the streets, whipping or flailing oneself, drawing blood from one's back, thus staining the white garments that you're wearing as an act of penance. And the interesting thing about these is that these groups practicing the mortification of the flesh in public rituals as a means of seeking penance during times of great suffering and fear, these existed prior to the Black Death. You find these during the 13th century. And during the 13th century, they had already reached the point of heresy or the charge of heresy by the church, as it became a sort of grassroots means of removing one's sin, effectively or at least to the powers that be, seeming to come dangerously close to cutting the power of the church out of the equation. Because what do you need church for when the power to remove sins resides in your own hands and your own flails? Even more so when this idea generates that merely witnessing a progression of flagellants through the streets can remove your sins.
If you're trying to picture a flagellant procession, people moving in formation through the streets, punishing their own bodies in order to enact the mortification of the flesh. And by the way, the mortification of the flesh, I mean, these people did point to sort of passages in the Bible that could be interpreted as giving them license to enact this kind of spiritual dealing where they, mm-hmm. Punishing the body or denying the body pleasure and inflicting pain on the body could in some way purify you in the eyes of God. Like there are passages in like the book of Romans where the Apostle Paul writes that for if you live after the flesh, you shall die. But if you live through the Spirit and through the Spirit do mortify the deeds of your body, you will live.
Yeah. And ultimately, the mortification of the flesh flagellant rites and so forth. It gets really complicated. I think we've looked into this on past episodes of the show because you're dealing with the pain and pleasure network of the brain. You're dealing with complex, mythic histories of suffering and the meaning of suffering. And so we see rites of this nature in religions around the world. It's nothing that's, completely isolated to these movements we're discussing here.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, but I forgot to complete the thought I started a moment ago. I was going to mention that flagellant groups and flagellant processions of the Middle Ages are parodied to great effect in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Do you remember the part where the monks, the brotherhood, they're walking through the streets and beating their own faces with the wooden boards?
Yep. those guys, especially with Terry Jones, they were very well read on medieval thought. So it makes sense that we would find such great parody there. But certainly, to get back to the point here, like these groups were around, this line of thinking already existed. And during the 14th century, the Black Death stirred this reaction again for obvious reasons. And so the practice surged and the practice even peaked during this time. People were realizing these other forms of prayer and religious rite were not working. What is the next level we should take things to? Maybe we should take to the streets like this.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting that the mortification of the flesh idea took on this public display, and I'm sure it wasn't always a public display, but like why in the cases of the people who led these processions in the streets, was it not enough just to mortify your flesh or punish your body in private? Why did you need to do it as a group in public? What was that accomplishing specifically? And I don't know the answer to that question.
It probably gets into some of what we discussed in our Tears episodes, that it's one thing to have an emotional outpouring that is individual or in a case of a sort of religious situation, a one-on-one communication with God. But if it is public and communal, then it takes on a different power.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today. Health Aid kombucha.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Now, there's an important distinction to be made here between just the practice and the movement of the flagellants here, because just the mere practice of the mortification of the flesh was largely considered an accepted form of penance within the church. But then when we talk about the movement, we're talking about something that is sometimes described as a mania that ultimately was beyond the control of the church. And that's where we see the crackdown on groups such as these. And also sometimes those crackdowns were rolled up in the persecution of other heresies.
Yeah, that's right. Because a number of things could count as supposed mortification of the flesh. And these would be all kinds of things you hear about, you know, Christians in the Middle Ages doing in a totally sanctioned way all the time, like fasting is a form of mortification of the flesh. You are denying yourself fleshly, carnal pleasures in terms of food or whatever, or even just assuming poses that are uncomfortable for long periods of time as a way of turning your mind to God, like kneeling for long periods or something. Mm-hmm. But you're making the distinction that in the Middle Ages, there arose these movements that were sort of organized and highly devoted to the flagellant practice. And these were sometimes condemned and seen as troublemakers by the church authorities.
Right. And you can, you know, it ultimately gets into a complex area because you can say, well, okay, if the church believes that they have the path to salvation, it's their job to keep people from altering the recipe to the point where it's no longer producing the desired results or, you know, causing greater harm. But then on the other hand, you know, it is also about power. You know, if a group has determined that it has reached the point where it is limiting the power of the church, well, then it becomes a threat to the church, right?
Yeah. Another thing we should, of course, say is that the threats represented by these flagellant groups, it was not just a threat to the authority of the church structure. They were also doing very bad things in some cases. Like, there were cases where flagellant groups were involved in, say, the persecution of minority groups within the communities.
Right. And that's where we get to another, you know, huge area that comes out of the religious response to the Black Death, the persecution of minority groups, including the persecution of Jewish communities.
Mm-hmm.
So Jewish communities had often been the target of, say, blood libel and accusations of various crimes and events. And in response to the Black Death, there were vile accusations that the plague outbreaks were due to Jewish people poisoning wells.
Yeah.
Now, certainly, well poisoning has been used as a weapon of war, had been used since in war and conflict since very ancient times. We see accounts of it being used by the Assyrians and others. But there was no well poisoning going on here, and it's not even how this particular illness would have readily spread.
Right.
There's an interesting article that I was reading about some of this. Peter Schwartzstein's The History of Poisoning of the Well in Smithsonian, which gets into this larger trend, like how far back does this go, especially in ancient Mesopotamian conflict. But the author also gets into these accusations of well poisoning a little bit during the Black Death. I also found a very good write-up on specifically the anti-Semitic activities during the Black Death on jewishhistory.org that has a good write-up.
Now, it should be stated that this was not the first time in history there had been anti-Jewish persecution in Europe, but this was that was a long tradition going back in many ways to the early days of the church, but this was a big spike in it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that line of behavior, that line of lashing out with hatred against the Jewish people and other minority communities, like that was already established. So then comes the Black Death. These other religious options were kind of explored and in some cases eventually exhausted, you know, asking yourself, well, why are we being punished? Is it because of a failure in the Crusades? Is it rampant sin? Is it probably problems in the church, etc.? So they end up turning then to these Jewish communities. And the idea of mass poisoning by Jewish communities was something that had already been raised in previous persecution efforts, sometimes with lepers thrown into the accusation as well. So it gets into this whole conspiracy-based, illogical territory of, like, you know, the Jewish people and lepers working together to poison us and create disease.
Right.
And as Schorstein points out in his article, this was already happening, you know, before the Black Death, in response to a lot of waterborne illnesses, for example, but then the Black Death gave it new life. And so you saw regulations put in place in cities like Vienna, where Jewish people were banned from consuming food and drink that was intended for Christians. And this madness basically continued till the 15th century. And along the way, we saw the persecution and the slaughter of Jews, the Roma people as well, other minority groups. Pope Clement VI actually outlawed it in an attempt to protect Jewish communities, but that only worked so much. I mean, the horrible acts of expulsion and genocide continued. So one of the really interesting things about all of this is that, again, none of these religion-based attempts to thwart the plague really worked. And to a large extent, the church of the 14th century was just met with this terrible test, and they failed. People turned to the church, and it was unable to help in the larger sense of preventing the illness, but even the smaller instances of providing a framework for the suffering. There was a lot of pessimism during this period toward the powers that be, and you read accounts of, say, churchmen not interacting with the lay people out of fear of death, and that included, say, like last rites for the dying. So there was this idea that the church was forsaking people just as people were forsaking each other in the wake of this illness.
There's actually interesting debate from the time period about what is the appropriate course of action for Christians and for the clergy in reaction to the plague. Like a big question was, should you flee the plague or not, or should you flee or should you stay to help your Christian brethren? And actually, like, there's a whole Martin Luther essay where he talks about this debate, this argument about whether you have a duty to stay or whether you should flee.
Yeah, and now this is not to say that everyone just outright abandoned Christianity, but there was an increased turning away from the church in search of, quote, a different understanding of the Christian message and walk of faith. This according to Joshua J. Mark, who wrote about it in 2020's Religious Responses to the Black Death. You also get into this argument that ultimately this kind of religious crisis in Europe kind of laid the groundwork for the Protestant Reformation of later centuries.
Yeah, Martin Luther's famous 95 Theses were published in the early 16th century, I believe, like the 15 teens at some point. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, at the time, in the centuries following the Black Death itself in the 14th century, there were still recurrent waves of plague popping up here and there throughout Europe. So it wasn't like the plague went away after the Black Death, as we've talked about. The plague continued to be an ongoing issue for the centuries that followed.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to come back just very briefly to one of the sources I cited last time, The Anthropology of Plague by Sharon N. DeWitt, published in Pandemic Disease in the Medieval World from 2014. So as the author points out, the Black Death initiated or accelerated social, demographic, and economic changes throughout the region. So there are changes that were already in motion to some degree, but the Black Death arguably sped them up, made them more urgent, more actionable, etc. Though again, we get into this very difficult to hammer out area of trying to imagine what the future would have been like had something not occurred. Like, what was the trajectory of of religion in Europe, and how would an absence of plague have affected that trajectory? Because even if you took plague out of the scenario, you still had famine, you still had war, you still had people suffering and living this, often, degraded standard of living within a feudal system. Mm-hmm. So all of those elements were still in place. All of those elements were already, pushing some of the changes to come. So, I don't know. It's difficult to tease it all apart and try and figure out what would have happened had the plague not happened. And if not this plague, I mean, potentially some other plague. It's not like this was the only illness affecting the people of Europe during these centuries.
And as we've mentioned previously, of course, it's important to keep in mind that despite the sort of Eurocentric dominance of the historical analyses of the plague that exists, the second plague pandemic did not only affect Christian Europe. I mean, it affected large portions of the world. It affected Europe, Africa, and Asia. And so another really interesting area of study is looking at Islamic societies and how they reacted to the plague in their own ways. As I've mentioned several times, this is an area that seems somewhat complicated because much like the scientific history of the plague pandemic itself, the subject of the Islamic religious response to plague has, I think, undergone some recent revision and re-examination. Looking at the time, I think we maybe do need to save most of this discussion for the next episode. But just as a hint of things to come, I did want to read a passage that I found really haunting. This was cited in, again, that essay I mentioned earlier by Michael W. Doles from the 70s. And so Doles is pointing out that while the majority of historical scholarship, especially at the time he was writing, but probably still, the majority of scholarship on the Second Plague Pandemic has focused on its effects on Europe, it was also extremely destructive and historically significant in the Muslim world at the time, including in the Middle East, in North Africa, and Andalusia and so forth. And to describe this state of affairs, Doles quotes from a 14th century Arab Muslim historian and philosopher named Ibn Khaldun. Ibn Khaldun is a very important intellectual of the Middle Ages who did work that I think could be seen as a precursor to many of the social sciences. So he did work sort of examining different, things that might be considered sociology later. And he tried to do sort of political analysis of the course of empires and their economic histories and things like this. But he also wrote about the plague that was taking place during his own lifetime. And so I want to read a passage that's translated here by Rosenthal. Ibn Khaldun writes, in the middle of the 8th century, and that would be the 8th century by the calendar he was working with, as what we've been referring to as the 14th century, civilization in the East and West was visited by a destructive plague which devastated nations and caused populations to vanish. It swallowed up many of the good things of civilization and wiped them out. It overtook the dynasties at the time of their senility, when they had reached the limit of their duration. It lessened their power and curtailed their influence. It weakened their authority. Their situation approached the point of annihilation and dissolution. Civilization decreased with the decrease of mankind. Cities and buildings were laid waste. Roads and way signs were obliterated. Settlements and mansions became empty. Dynasties and tribes grew weak. The entire inhabited world changed. The East, it seems, was similarly visited, though in accordance with and in proportion to its civilization. The author gives a note that's, according to Khaldun's estimation, the East's more affluent civilization. And then he finishes by writing, "It was as if the voice of existence in the world had called out for oblivion and restriction, and the world had responded to its call."
Oh, wow.
What a harrowing piece of writing. That is amazing.
Yeah, that gave me goosebumps a little bit there. And really, it drives home so many of the points we've been making or that have been made in the sources we've been citing here.
Yeah. And Doles actually fills in that Ibn Khaldun himself lost his parents and a number of his teachers to the Black Death. I think he was living in Tunis at the time in modern-day Tunisia, but he dwelled in North Africa at the time. And of course, it was affected just like the other side of the Mediterranean was.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to go ahead and close out this part 2, but we'll be back with part 3 next week, I believe on Tuesday. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, if you would like to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you'll find them in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. We have core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, listener mail on Mondays, Artifact on Wednesdays. On Friday, we do a little Weird House Cinema. That's our time to just mostly discuss a weird movie. And on the weekends, we run a Vault episode, which is a fancy way of saying we do a rerun.
Huge thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.